from NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Carmen Maria Machado's memoir of an abusive relationship is called In the Dream House. The acclaimed writer and previous National Book Award finalist walks us through this dream house room by room, each character taking shape in a different genre. It's hard to describe what this memoir is. Like a dream, it shapeshifts from moment to moment, memory to memory. But it's not hard to describe what it does. Machado's book gives us a bravely intimate, powerfully researched exploration and exposition of what abuse can look like and how it's experienced in an LGBTQ relationship. So this hour on Point, a conversation with Carmen Maria Machado. And you can join us. What questions do you have about intimate partner violence in the LGBTQ community? What questions do you have for acclaimed writer Carmen Maria Machado? Join us anytime online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Carmen Maria Machado joins us today from Philadelphia. She's a writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania, an author of the 2017 short story collection, and National Book Award finalist Her Body and Other Parties. Her most recent memoir is In the Dream House, and we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Carmen, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's terrific to have you. I was wondering if you could start off by actually just reading an excerpt right from near the beginning of In the Dream House, from the section titled Dream House as Luck of the Draw. If you could just set it up for us and read it to us, I think I would just love to have people hear the lyricism of your writing right from the top of the show here.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, to set it up a little bit, each chapter of the book sort of has a sort of genre element or a trope or something else as sort of an organizing principle. So this one is Luck of the Draw. When you started writing about fatness a long time ago in your live journal, a commenter said to you that you were pretty and smart and charming, but as long as you were Zoftig, you'd never have your choice of lovers. You remember feeling outrage and then processing the reality, the practicality of what he'd said. You were so angry at the world. You wondered when she came along if this was what most people got to experience in their lives, a straight line from want to satisfaction, desire manifested and satisfied in reasonable succession. This had never been the case before. It had always been fraught. How many times had you said, if I just looked a little different, I'd be drowning in love? Now you got to drown without needing to change a single cell. Lucky you.
It's Carmen Maria Machado reading from her memoir, In the Dream House. Now, we will talk about how you wrote this, because every reviewer, every conversation I've seen about this, people are just, they're gobsmacked at your skill and the approach that you take. But I'd love it, Carmen, before we get to that, though, is that you are telling a story of your life, a very powerful thing that happened to you. Can you just tell us sort of, let's do it this way, if I may, like in the dream house as radio conversation and tell us a little bit of the story of the abuse that you experienced.
Sure. So when I went to graduate school at this point many years ago, I met this really, what seemed to be an amazing woman who, I fell in love with, and she fell in love with me, and we began this really, what seemed like a really wonderful relationship in the beginning. And sort of as the relationship progressed, sort of little things began to happen, began to kind of crop up, and they got sort of bigger and scarier. And it just became this like very actually sort of destabilizing, really damaging, really terrifying relationship that then ended very dramatically at some point. And so, and that's it in a nutshell. I mean, I feel like.
You're right, in a nutshell, because obviously it's this very profound, complex thing which you take time and care to guide us through in the book, but how much did this relationship mean to you at the onset of it?
I mean, it meant a lot because, I mean, I had always been, you know, I knew I was queer. I had dated a lot of men, and this was my first sort of girlfriend that I'd ever had. And I remember in the beginning, it was so exciting thinking to myself, like, this is what I've been waiting for my whole life, is someone who loves me and like sees me for who I am and makes me feel really good. And I mean, it felt like everything that I had been looking for and everything that I hadn't gotten from all these other relationships.
And then it starts falling apart? I mean, what were some... I'm asking you these questions, Carmen, because I am very cognizant of the fact that there are probably a lot of people listening who, you know, as you write in the very beginning of the book, you know, if this book is for you, it's for you, meaning that that you're writing the experiences of many people. So just help us understand it. What were the first signs that the relationship wasn't what you were you had hoped for?
I mean, it's so funny because in many ways it feels like it started off so small. It's like a horror movie, you know, and there's like some little detail that's like a little out of place where, you know, in the beginning, you know, she would sort of, you know, sort of belittle me a little or sort of make fun of me, and she would sort of call me names or get very angry. She got very possessive and jealous of me, and when I would sort of be gone out of the house or I would talk about somebody in a particular way, she would accuse me of wanting to cheat on her or cheating on her. And yeah, there was just a lot of sort of little cruelties that kind of began to crop up. And she would sort of make me tell her what was wrong with me. So that was a thing she liked to do, was to make me sort of articulate the ways in which I was bad. And if I talked about myself in a way that expressed any sort of joy or like pride or anything about my life or myself, she would say, "Ah, oh, you're such an egomaniac. You just think you're the greatest." And, you know, after a while, I really began to believe the way that she would speak about me and the way that she would make me speak about myself. I began to truly believe that I had always thought that I was a good person and that actually I was a monster. So yeah, and then eventually it would sort of escalate into sort of more physical things like grabbing and throwing and running and sort of more physical stuff. But yeah, for a long time it was really just, it was primarily verbal and psychological.
So the cruelty of it as it creeps in is, it's just, it's kind of heart-stopping the way that you write about it. I'm wondering if you could read a little bit more about this, I was going to call it a subtle devolution, but I'm not even sure that's the right way of putting it. Mm-hmm. But from the section of the book called Dream House as Deja Vu, on how things begin to turn and change.
Of course. She says she loves you. She says she sees your subtle, ineffable qualities. She says you are the only one for her in all the world. She says she trusts you. She says she wants to keep you safe. She says she wants to grow old with you. She says she thinks you're beautiful. She says she thinks you're sexy. Sometimes when you look at your phone, she has sent you something weirdly ambiguous, and there is a kick of anxiety between your lungs. Sometimes when you catch her looking at you, you feel like the most scrutinized person in the world.
Carmen Maria Machado reading from her memoir, In the Dream House. Now, we'll talk more about the specifics of what you experienced, but from the early on in the memoir, you very directly grapple with sort of some of the preconceived notions that people have about LGBTQ relationships, about, you know, what abuse does or doesn't look like in these relationships. Can you tell us more about that and the misconceptions that people have?
Sure. Well, there's sort of this idea, I think, a sort of stereotype about especially lesbian relationships, that they're a kind of sort of ideal utopia, you know, that if you don't have sort of male nonsense kind of mixed up in it, that like your sort of day-to-day life is much easier and there's a kind of paradise. And I think that there's a feeling that if you are looking for that and you find it, it's actually quite magical. And that's true to a certain extent, you know, in the sense that when you're in a relationship with a woman, you know, there's a different sort of set of power structures at play than when you're in a relationship with a man. But that being said, I think that sort of translates into this idea that, like, women are incapable of being violent or abusive, and sort of on the other side of that, that men are incapable of being abused. And unfortunately, that translates into these very strange ways when it comes to sort of talking about queer intimate partner violence, where people think it's not possible or it's not as bad, or there's sort of also a cliche or sort of a stereotype about what they call mutual abuse, where it's like, well, if there is abuse, then it's both of them at the same time. So there's sort of a series of these ideas, and unfortunately, the queer community has not done a great job of trying to disabuse people of these ideas. I think that it doesn't exist. I think because we've been struggling for so long to sort of establish ourselves as like a category of human beings who deserve human rights, which we do. But unfortunately, that translates to let's prove ourselves to be sort of virtuous and perfect as opposed to being human beings who deserve rights.
And Towards the end of the memoir, there's a section that just I read it over and over again because it's so painfully revealing that you write about how there were times that you and how messed up this is, that there were times that you wished you had a picture of the evidence of physical abuse.
Yeah.
To sort of prove to people that something terrible had happened to you. And then you interrogate yourself even as you write that. Like, how messed up is that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the problem is that, you know, we and by we, I just mean people in general, get very attached to sort of legality and sort of like the way that structure gives us some understanding. So we say like, okay, it's not okay. It's not legal to like hit somebody or physically hurt them. And that becomes sort of, that translates into, well, that's bad. We know that's bad. But when you have abuse that doesn't necessarily like cross legal thresholds or isn't necessarily illegal, people struggle to sort of understand what that means. And when you describe it, I'll say like, well, so what? So in the book, like I write this section, I feel it's weird because I feel like as I wrote it, I remember writing it and thinking this is a horrible thing to write, but like thinking like, yeah, I wish I had like a photo of myself with a black eye so I could just say like, this is how bad it was. Not because, I mean, and I recognize like how truly ridiculous that is. And I recognize that that is a thing that people for whom that is a reality, like would obviously never wish that on anybody. But recognizing how painful it is to want to have proof of something that happened to you and not have it.
Hmm. Well, we are talking this hour with Carmen Maria Machado. Her memoir is In the Dream House. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And we want to hear from you specifically about the issue of how we understand and how we talk about abuse in LGBTQ relationships. And if you've read Carmen's new book, what do you think about it? There's a brave, brilliant way in which she guides us through this dream house. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Carmen Maria Machado. She is the former National Book Award finalist. She was a finalist in 2017 for her collection of short stories, Her Body and Other Parties. She's the author of the highly acclaimed memoir this year called In the Dream House, and we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Now, Carmen, I'm wondering if you could read a little bit more from In the Dream House. There's a section called Dream House as Chekhov's Trigger, where you very clearly write about how the abuse that you experience becomes far more overt. Could you read that section for us?
Sure. You walk inside with her screaming at your back. You are calm now. You've learned from last time. You're already stronger. In the bedroom, you strip off your clothes, then go into the bathroom, lock the door. The shower, hotter than you can stand. You are warmed immediately. The sound reminds you of a storm. Then she's there. Maybe you didn't lock the door properly. Maybe you didn't lock it at all. And she is still screaming. She rips the shower curtain down from its rings. You back up. You aren't wearing your glasses, so she is just this fuzzy, pale mass, and her mouth is a red hole. The water falls between you. I hate you, she says. I've always hated you. I know, you say. I want you to leave this house right now. I can't. I don't have my car. My flight is tomorrow. Leave this house, or I will make you leave. I'll sleep on the floor. I'll leave first thing. You won't even know I'm here. You slide down to the floor of the bathtub, sobbing, and she walks away. You sit there until the water hitting your body is icy. After a few minutes like that, you reach over and turn the handle to off, shivering.
Carmen Maria Machado, reading from In the Dream House. Now, of course, Carmen, that section ends with her coming back into the bathroom and asking you, why are you crying? Can you tell us about that moment?
Yeah. So sort of one of the, I guess, characteristics of sort of what happened was there were certain events that would take place, sort of the worst of them, the most scary, where afterwards she would sort of claim that she had no memory of what had happened. She would act, she would say, like, why are you crying? Why are you so upset? And I would say, well, because of everything that just happened. And she would pretend, or rather, she would say that she had no memory of it. Whether or not that's true is sort of anyone's guess. But it became sort of this defining feature of the sort of latter part of our relationship and was very scary to me. And of course, was also sort of functioned as this sort of kind of, I mean, gaslighting, which is the thing I talk about in the book a lot, where I began to sort of doubt, like, you know, is it possible that it's not as, it wasn't as scary as I remembered it being? And it was a very, like, traumatizing, very troubling sort of element of the relationship.
Gaslighting being a form of abuse that changes one's perception of reality, right? That where the abuser says what you think is true is not.
Yeah, the idea that your own perception is unreliable and sort of makes you doubt your own sort of stability or sort of mental state.
So this, for someone who hasn't, for people who haven't experienced this directly in an intimate relationship, I mean, it's, how do you cope with that? How did you, when she would come in and say those things, I mean, were you like, wait a minute, no, you're wrong. This just happened. I mean, how did you cope in those moments?
No. I mean, she became so distressed that then she started crying and then I would have to comfort her. And I feel like, you know, and then I would return to my home. I would return home and then, you know, be trying to figure out, like, what could have happened, like, what could explain what had just happened in a way in which it was not her fault, you know, and, like, sort of, like, Googling a lot of things. I mean, like, what can make somebody, like, forget that they did something really scary or make them do something scary in that way and not have any memory of it and not be accountable for it? I mean, in retrospect, I was just trying to explain it away, but at the time, I really couldn't, I think I couldn't bring myself to believe that, you know, that she was doing these things on purpose or that there was any kind of intention behind them, because I think that was just so unthinkable to me and something I couldn't really wrap my brain around.
I have to ask, I mean, is it at all possible that what she was saying about her perceptions of the moment were true?
It's very possible, but I have no way of knowing, you know. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, I feel like writing this book, there were a lot of sort of moments of, you know, asking myself questions about intentionality and memory and did she know, did she not know, does she have a sense of it, does she not have a sense of it? And the fact of the matter is I'll never know the answer to those questions, you know, and I have to sort of, that was a thing I had to accept and understand for myself, was that, like, there are things to which there are, I will never have a satisfactory answer. And that's just the reality of my life, you know. That's just the reality of the situation.
It's why this metaphor of in the dream house is so powerful, right? Because how can one tell? Where are the bounds? Where between what's real and what's perceived, between her reality and yours? Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that one is right and one is wrong, but that's kind of one of the main things that you're grappling with here.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's complicated in the sense that because it doesn't sort of fit into a sort of a neat legal framework, that sort of what to call it or how to sort of, you know, put it into that kind of putting into like a sort of structure in the way that we normally would think about abuse is very difficult. But in many ways, I mean, it did fit. I mean, the sort of the cycles of it, you know, going between these like very scary, intense moments and then there's like, you know, these moments of lightness and love and tenderness and the way it sort of, she sort of used those other things as a way of sort of keeping me sort of in this circle. Like in that way, it actually fit like a very sort of classic intimate partner violence or domestic abuse, like, you know, sort of framework. And then that's actually like just how it works. That's how it always functions. It was just different in the sense that like it's hard to sort of, there's no way to legislate it. You know, there's no way to sort of bring in like a sort of legal framework to what happened, which I think is what most people are used to thinking about when they think about things like domestic abuse.
Right, because, I mean, you just before the section that you just read in the book, you say that most types of domestic abuse are completely legal, that this was kind of an epiphany for you.
Yeah. It's funny. I remember writing that section, and I wrote Dream House's Epiphany, and then I wrote, you know, most types of domestic abuse are completely legal. And then I thought, do I have anything else to say about that? And I was like, no, I don't. That's the end of my thought. You know, and I just left this as like single sentence because it really was like a very like a moment of realizing like, oh, wow. I mean, and it's funny because we know like we know that the legal system and that the police and that, you know, law is a very like limited framework that offers like incredibly limited visions of justice for like a lot of people, you know. And so it's actually not that surprising to realize like, ah, actually that's a framework that isn't incredibly useful to a lot of kinds of injustice, you know, which was the thing that, I mean, I knew, but I think I had to articulate to myself. And that was a very sort of important part of writing the book.
Well, we are talking this hour with Carmen Maria Machado. Her memoir is In the Dream House. It is a spectacular memoir that very bravely looks at her experience with intimate partner abuse in an LGBTQ relationship. Let's go to Addie, who's calling from Springfield, Illinois. Addie, you're on the air.
Hi, Carmen. Hi, Meghna. Thank you so much for taking my call. So I just wanted to ask Carmen a question about talking to LGBTQ youth about intimate partner violence, because as a little bit of background, when I was very young, when I was in high school, I was in a relationship so similar to what you are describing that it's almost a little bit frightening. And I did not realize that I was being abused, in part because it was my first relationship, and in part because I didn't realize that I could be abused by a woman, because I had never been told that before. So I would love to know, Carmen, what ideas you have for how we should start changing the narrative around how we talk to LGBTQ youth about abuse, because it's dangerous for people not to know this. So I would love to know what you think about that.
Yeah, thanks. No, thanks. That's a really, really great question. And I mean, I sort of want to preface my answer by saying, like, I am not an expert. And I feel like there are a lot of experts on this topic who I think I would love to hear their input just sort of in general, sort of in the conversation. But I think, you know, one of the problems, I think this is true both for queer youth, but also for non-queer youth, which is that, like, you know, we have, I mean, in some places we have sex ed. I guess we don't have it everywhere and we do need it everywhere. But on the other sort of side of it, we really need relationship education. I feel like there is simply not a way that we talk to youth as, you know, in sort of en masse about like what is okay or acceptable in relationships. And I think, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, a thing that I notice, and I sort of notice it everywhere, you know, now that this experience has happened to me, like, for example, I notice how we romanticize jealousy, like how we sort of fetishize jealousy and we think like, oh, it's so romantic when my partner is like, is insanely jealous of me, you know, doesn't want me to talk to other people or whatever. And I'm like, that is not healthy or okay. And I really wish we told teenagers that, you know, as they're embarking on relationships, because unfortunately it's like in the conversation, it's like in the zeitgeist, it's like you see it in media, you see it on social, you see it kind of everywhere. And I feel like saying to them like, that is not normal or okay is actually like really important. So honestly, like, I mean, I think obviously with queer youth, I think there's like this additional element of the conversation, which is like they're not getting representation of their relationships as much as like straight teens are. But I also think in general, like we need to be talking to teenagers about relationships and healthy relationships and what they look like or don't look like, because I don't think we give them that language. And I think in the same breath as saying like, you know, here's how you use condoms, here's how you do all this other stuff, like I think we also should say to them like, here's what's okay and here's what's not okay. And this is like a warning sign.
Well, yeah. I mean, so in the memoir, you write about how, you know, your own eyes were opened to the fact, I mean, in your words, that what you experienced was common, right? I mean, you write that, quote,
yeah,
it was a terrible thing to discover that I was common, that everything that happened to me was detailed in books and reports, in statistics. It was terrible because I wanted to believe that my love was unique and my pain was unique. All of us do. What do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, that, I mean, so one of the weirdest sort of parts about writing a book about intimate partner violence and about doing all this research for this book is that, like, it's like, you know, your pain when it's happening to you, it feels so, I mean, obviously it's very real, but it also feels unique if it's the first time it's happened to you, and you're like, but the truth is that, like, intimate partner violence is very much, it functions in a very sort of cliched way. You know, the way that abusers function, it's kind of out, it feels like it's out of a handbook. Like, it's actually quite, when you strip away all the details, it's actually just this very sort of, these common cycles that sort of function in these very, very explicable and trackable ways. And if you know what to look for, you can almost predict, like, how it's going to sort of move. And so because of that, you know, yeah, so I kept thinking, like, I wanted to believe that what happened to me was this incredibly unique and specific thing, but actually it wasn't. And, like, to read books, you know, books that were written, like, when I was a child or even before I was born, or to, like, read accounts of people's romantic sort of abusive experiences in romantic relationships and realizing that, like, what happened to me was just, like, one tiny node of data in, like, a sea of it. And there's something really scary about that. And really strange to realize, like, oh, actually, my pain is not unique at all. Mm. And that was also just, like, part of writing the book. It was, like, a very strange sort of emotional piece of it, I guess.
So we should talk a lot more about how you wrote the book. Because I've never read anything like it in my whole life. It's amazing. Let me just ask with some, start with some basic questions.
Sure.
You use the second person almost all the way through it.
Yeah.
You're talking to a you, not an I. Why'd you do that?
Well, it's funny because when I handed in the first draft of the book, which was, you know, very sort of skeletal, to my publisher, basically my editor was like, so it's in second person. And I was like, oh, is it? Because I had actually written it sort of unintentionally in second. And then later when I went back to it to sort of make sure that I was doing so with intention, and I actually tried to put it back into first or to put it into first, and it wasn't working for me. And eventually I was thinking, there's this novel that I really love called We the Animals by Justin Torres, which is a book that is told in a plural first voice, like a we, in which an act of trauma sort of splits and separates the voice and into, like, different sort of second and first and third. And I became very interested in this idea that, you know, trauma could sort of shatter a perspective. And so I ended up writing the book with a first person voice throughout, which is my voice, like the me who's speaking to all of you right now and, you know, went on and, like, lived her life. And then the second person voice, that's like the me in her early 20s, sort of trapped on this, like, eternal hamster wheel of pain, and she can't get out, and she doesn't know what's happening, and she can't hear the I, she can't hear my voice, because she's just sort of stuck in the past. And, like, this book was in many ways like me talking at her, you know, and sort of trying to have a relationship with this you voice. So yes, yeah, so it actually ended up becoming this, like, very interesting sort of method by which I was sort of I was exploring, you know, the way trauma sort of splits and separates, and how we have a relationship or don't with, like, these past iterations of ourselves, you know, and if they're living or dead, or, you know, what it means to sort of look at them and talk at them.
I mean, in a way, I feel like for different reasons, so all of us kind of want to do this as we progress in life, to have that conversation with our younger, more, much more vulnerable selves.
Yeah.
And you've done it here. I mean, how is that, has that changed your perception of what your experience was or the person that you were?
I mean, I feel a lot of tenderness and compassion toward that young version of myself. Not even just the version that was in the relationship, but just who you are, who I was in my early 20s, you know. And yeah, I think maybe that is a part of getting older, I guess, is like looking back and saying, like, oh my goodness, like, oh honey, you know, like that little old version of yourself where you're like, oh my, that is certainly a choice, a series of choices that you made, sweetie pie, you know, and feeling like, you know, a slight amount of condescension and also love and tenderness toward that young person. But yeah, I mean, I feel like it's a way of, you know, like, and sort of, I think, feeling, because I think it's really, it's easy to feel compassion toward other people more than it is to feel compassion toward yourself. And I think that thinking about this past version of yourself as another person, as opposed to yourself, is actually, does make it easier to feel compassion toward the choices that you made as a young person, or a younger person. And I think that was actually very useful and helpful to me, to, like, look at her as if she were, like, a student of mine or a friend, you know, as opposed to just me, who I'm very hard on all the time. So yeah, it was helpful.
Well, you also never name the woman. I'm obviously not going to ask you to name her now, but you also don't give her a pseudonym. Why is that?
I don't think any pseudonym felt correct. It's interesting. I just read this really incredible, there's a really incredible memoir that just came out by, an author where she gives him a pseudonym. And I remember thinking, it's called What We Didn't Talk About When I Was a Girl. And I remember thinking that, you know, the pseudonym was such an interesting move, but I don't know. I felt like giving her a name felt like giving her a kind of dignity that she never gave me. And I don't know, I couldn't bring myself to do it.
Well, we're talking with Carmen Maria Machado about her memoir, In the Dream House. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking with Carmen Maria Machado this hour about her new memoir, In the Dream House. There's an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And Carmen, I'm wondering if you could read a little bit more from In the Dream House, a particular section called Dream House as Choose Your Own Adventure.
Yes. You wake up and the air is milky and bright. The room glows with a kind of effervescent contentment, despite the boxes and clothes and dishes. You think to yourself, this is the kind of morning you could get used to. When you turn over, she is staring at you. The luminous innocence of the light curdles in your stomach. You don't remember ever going from awake to afraid so quickly. You were moving all night, she says. Your arms and elbows touched me. You kept me awake. If you apologize profusely, go to page 163. If you tell her to wake you up next time your elbows touch her in your sleep, go to page 164. If you tell her to calm down, go to page 166.
Carmen Maria Machado, reading from her memoir, In the Dream House. So how did you manage to do this? How did you manage to, I really want to know, occupy so many different genres, from, you know, the serious to the kind of pulpy. I personally have a great affection for Choose Your Own Adventures from my childhood. But you did it without it ever coming off as being gimmicky.
Yeah. I mean, I've always been very interested in form and genre. I mean, it's true in my fiction. Apparently, it's true about my nonfiction as well. I just feel like I really get to shine sort of both in terms of my writing and also my, my mind. I feel like it's when I have like a form or a structure or a trope that I can sort of like hold on to, it gives me like all this room to move that I find very pleasurable and find very interesting. So this section in particular, I actually, early on, I had like all these notes, and somewhere in the notes I had written gaslight the reader ? Because I was sort of thinking about, you know, ways in which the form could sort of create certain effects for the reader, in which they could sort of understand certain pieces of my experience. And I was really interested in, I was trying all these different sort of methods, and then I was thinking about how, you know, Choose Your Own Adventure, there's this, like, this illusion of choice, mm-hmm. you know, but ultimately you have like two or three choices per page, and there's sort of these many pre-prescribed sort of paths you can go down, really only one of which will ever sort of save you, and even that isn't really going to save you. And I felt like as a form, it actually offered me, you know, you can get stuck in cycles and you can get trapped and you can break the rules or not break the rules. Like, there's all these ways in which the form offers experiences for the reader that I thought were very interesting. And so, yeah, so I just decided to make that not a chapter in the book.
I just want to talk about Choose Your Own Adventure for a little bit more. and why this chapter in particular I thought was just a tour de force, really. Because, you know, when I was a kid, I'd go to the library. I'd sit in front of the section of the library that had all the Choose Your Own Adventure books, you know, crisscross applesauce, and I would, like, read them all. Some of them I would do them linearly just to see what would happen. Others I would do the same Choose Your Own Adventure, like, 65 times or, you know, you get caught in those recursive loops, et cetera. The whole thing. Like, I'd spend entire days in the library doing this. But it's because part of the reason, looking back now, is because it gave me a sense of control over our power over life, which simply just does not exist. It gives you, like, a godlike complex when you're eight. And the reason why I felt it was so powerful in this context, as you're talking about the abuse that you experienced, is because you had you had the complete opposite of that. You were powerless. You had no control. It wasn't as if you could. I mean, every moment of our lives, we are making choices, but there's no sense that the choice is going to lead down the path that you hope for. So here, being able to go through those loops over and over again, it kind of gave me a sense of how, I don't know what the word is, confusing, debilitating, traumatizing it must be to experience this in real time.
Yeah. And I mean, I wanted, like, there are some choices you can pick where if you do it, the book will tell you, like, you would never do this or you didn't do this.
Right.
Like, why are you pretending? And if you break the rules, so if you try to read it linearly, like, you go to a page that isn't, you don't get there by choice. The book yells at you.
You're a monster. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was actually, there's this writer I really love, Kevin Brockmeyer, who was a teacher of mine when I was at Iowa. And he has this really beautiful Choose Your Own Adventure story called The Human Soul is a Rube Goldberg Device. And that also had a hidden page. And I remember being very, like, intrigued by the hidden page. And by the way, it, like, offered this, like, other, and I mean, the tone of his story is as different as it possibly could be from this chapter of my memoir. But I just sort of felt like the idea that, you know, somebody else is calling the shots, you know, like, you think you have choices, but you actually don't. Like, your choices are, you're running along these pre-prescribed, pre-written sort of tracks that somebody else has laid out for you. And the way that sort of mimics this sense of this lack of control, which I obviously, is sort of the opposite of what you'd expect from this form or this structure.
Right.
But I really, that really spoke to me as, like, a sort of a different way of thinking about this form in particular. And the events of the book where you can just, you know, you just can get stuck in these loops. And I mean, and the events of the chapter center around waking up in the morning and being yelled at for what I did in my sleep, which also was a thing that I can't control, you know, and how that would happen every morning. And it just felt like this sort of ritual we had to go through. And that just became, like, this form felt like the perfect way of sort of capturing the effect of that and then relaying that to the reader and saying, like, you know, you cannot know what I experienced in this moment, but you can get pretty close if I can sort of run you through this, you know?
Yeah. Well, you have so many different genres here. Dream House's lesbian pulp novel, Dream House's unreliable narrator. I'm just flipping through. Dream House's doppelganger as high fantasy. Why did you decide that this was the way you wanted to do this memoir?
Well, for many years after the experience, I tried to write about it in various ways. And I was trying to do it, and I mean, it never really worked. And what I realized later is because I was trying to do it in a straightforward way. I was trying to, you know, just simply say, well, this happened, then this happened. And then at some point I realized, like, it wasn't correct. And I was actually teaching this really wonderful course. I was teaching high school students, having, like, this wonderful, like, writing camp. And I was talking a lot about genre because when I teach genre, sort of the way that I frame a lot of my sort of craft lectures and things. And so I was thinking a lot about different genres and what genres offer us in terms of readerly expectations and how you sort of meet or subvert them. And I began thinking about this material in terms of haunted houses and the gothic, which is a genre that I've been very interested in for many years now. And then thought, well, why just the gothic and haunted houses? Why not, you know, high fantasy or generationship or murder mystery or anything else? And then I just began to, like, take notes. And as soon as that form occurred to me, the whole thing kind of just fell out of me. Like, I suddenly realized, like, this is what I needed, is, like, because so much of what how I feel about this event or this series of events is unresolved, the way to sort of go at it and to sort of process it, or not process it, but to write about it, is to sort of hold it up to the light and like turn it in every direction and look at it from every possible angle. And for me, that just manifested as genre and as, you know, thinking about, like, if I think about it this way, like, what do I learn? If I think about it as time travel, what does that teach me? Mm. If I think about it as a choose your own adventure, what does that show me? If I think about it as, you know, this thing or that thing, like, what is that going to show me about what happened to me and how to think about it? And it just became, and then once I started doing that, it just, the whole thing made sense.
Well, if I may, anyone who brings in Star Trek: The Next Generation is a winner in my book.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
That show was so formative, so profoundly formative in my in my young girlhood. I'm not gonna, no spoiler alerts. We want people to read the book when they get to that chapter. Just know that, like, that also, I know exactly the episode you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I have seen it 100 times. The lessons that it imparts. Okay, it's spot on, Carmen. It's spot on.
Well, it's so funny because I wrote that when I was actually like at a residency working on this project, and I had it kind of going in the background because I find that show very soothing, because I also watched it as a child, and I just, it gives me this like deep shot of nostalgia that I just love. And then of course, like seeing this episode as an adult, this particular episode that I write about, and then having, like, you know, the experience of my life and suddenly having a lot of different context for what was happening in it was like very alarming and very strange. And I was like, oh, I have to write about this, obviously. Yeah. So, yeah.
I used to watch the show with my dad religiously, and I feel like I learned so much about humanity sitting next to my dad watching Jean-Luc Picard. But listen, we have a lot of callers who have been patiently waiting. I'm just going to kind of give the last several minutes of the show over to them.
Sure.
So let's go to Robin, who's calling from Brattleboro, Vermont. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say compassion, that women in lesbian relationships are two women, and women have, if you think about how sexism and the patriarchy has affected us over thousands of years, loving another woman is about a woman loving another woman is about the most profound thing someone can do, or one of the most profound things. And it sure isn't easy. And we have, you know, this funny joke about lesbian relationships. On the first night, they bring people bring a U-Haul. Women do romanticize what it's like to be in a lesbian relationship, and it's hard. It is. Don't bring a U-Haul. Don't expect an easy ride. It's hard. Women are just getting in touch with their anger, and Me Too. And how women express their anger is emotional. I mean, of course, it's not going to be as physically battering a relationship, but women hurt each other a lot. And but compassion is, and love for each other, and a lesbian relationship teaches you that.
Right. Well, Robin, I'm going to jump in here because I want to be sure to give a little bit of time for some other callers. But Robin, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your call. Let's go to Spice, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Spice, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I've been in a relationship for 25 years, and we are grandmothers, which is wonderful. And about 15 years ago, my mother was dying, and I became very critical, and I became, and I still can do that, but it was really hard. And my spouse, she was in a relationship in the past where there was some gaslighting and criticism, and it was really hard. And I realized that I had to change. And we went to therapy, and I got on some anti-anxiety medication because I wanted to save my relationship, because it was so good in so many ways. And I just appreciate this book. I appreciate your honesty. And I also teach youth with Unitarian Universalist our whole lives, and that we have a lot of LGBTQ youth, and I think it's important that they learn these things, no matter who they love.
Well, Spice, thank you so much for your call. Carmen, do you have a thought to share with Spice?
Oh, I mean, I think that that actually, I mean, I think the idea also that, you know, one of the things about writing this book that was so interesting is like thinking a lot about, you know, can people change? Can people recognize their own sort of toxic patterns and you know, sort of behaviors and make a point of changing? And I do think that, that it is in some circumstances possible. And I think that the idea of saying like, this is not okay or acceptable and I want to make, you know, make changes and like have this relationship be something that's healthy and good is like really admirable and great and is, I think, in some cases possible. And so that's, I mean, that's really wonderful that that worked out in that way.
Hmm. Let's go to Elisa, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Elisa, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of mention something similar to what the last caller said. So I was, something hit me when Carmen said that she would like hide in the bathroom and then her partner would come in and say that she didn't realize what she was saying or didn't live up to it or and then started crying herself. Well, I've been diagnosed with EPD and my first relationship was like that. And I was the abuser where I would have episodes and not realize what I was saying or doing, but that was still not okay. And it wasn't until that relationship ended that I sought, you know, therapy and help. And I've been in there for years and, you know, I don't feel myself as toxic anymore, but definitely there was a time when I was an abuser and that guilt still lives with me. So if I hope if anyone's out there and, you know, kind of recognizes themselves, you know, go seek help.
Yeah. Well, Elisa, thank you so much for your call. Carmen, I was going to ask you how it's felt to you that I presume so many people have come to you saying, I recognize myself in your story, in terms of what you experienced, mm-hmm. but now also hearing these calls, have people been coming to you and saying, I recognize myself, at least shades of myself, in terms of what your partner was?
Yeah, I have heard from a few folks, not nearly as many, but yeah. Certainly that has come up. Yeah, and I think, I mean, I sort of want to underline that, like, I am not, like, for... excuse me, for having written this book, I am not like an expert in this field, but I do think that there's something about saying like, you know, I'm unhappy with the way that I am or the way that I treat somebody in my life that means a lot to me. Like I think thinking of certain behaviors as just like unchangeable is not necessarily useful or helpful. But I also think that, you know, sort of acknowledging and saying, like, I did something that's not okay. And it's, I mean, I think that's, like, actually really important in this sense of sort of being sort of self-critical and thinking, like, what could I do better? How could I make my relationships healthier? I think is actually really, really sort of admirable and really great. And I think that the important thing is to remember that, like, if you are a person who's having that conversation with yourself, that it isn't necessarily your job to have that conversation with the person who has sort of been on the negative end of your behavior. But that is like a personal thing that you have to sort of figure out for yourself. And I think that that's, I mean, when that happens and when that's possible, that's actually really great.
Well, Carmen Maria Machado, she's a writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania. Her 2017 collection of short stories, Her Body and Other Parties, was a finalist for the National Book Award. I'm presuming similar accolades will befall you, Carmen, for your memoir, In the Dream House. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. It's been a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.